is a grey port built on the grey rocks of Esagel Bay. A rainy sea wind blows in the streets, and the people are grim seamen, straight-spoken. I look back with praise to Ethwyn, where my luck changed. I bought skis, snowshoes, traps, and provisions, acquired my hunter's license and authorization and identification and so forth from the Commensal Bureau, and set out afoot up the Esagel with a party of hunters led by an old man called Mavriva. The river was not yet frozen, and wheels were on the road still, for it rained more than it snowed on this coastal slope, even now in the year's last month. Most hunters waited till full winter, and in the month of Thurn went up the Esagel by ice boat. But Mavriva meant to get far north early and trap the Pestri as they first came down into the forests in their migration. Mavriva knew the hinterlands, the North Sembensian, and the Fiery Hills as well as any man knows them, and in those days going upriver I learned much from him that served me later. At the town called Turuf I dropped out of the party, feigning illness. They went on north, after which I struck out northeastward by myself, into the high foothills of the Sembensian. I spent some days learning the land, and then, caching almost all I carried in a hidden valley 12 or 13 miles from Turuf, I came back to the town, approaching it from the south again, and this time entered it and put up at the transient house. As if stocking up for a trapping run, I bought skis, snowshoes, and provisions, a fur bag and winter clothing all over again. Also, a chaib stove, a potty-skin tent, and a light sledge to load it all on. Then, nothing to do but wait for the rain to turn to snow and the mud to ice. Not long, for I had spent over a month on my way from Mishnori to Turuf. On Arhad Thern, the winter was frozen in, and the snow I had waited for was falling. I passed the electric fences of Pulefin Farm in early afternoon, all track and trace behind me soon covered by the snowfall. I left the sledge in a stream gully well into the forest east of the farm, and carrying only a backpack, snowshoed back around to the road. Along it I came openly to the farm's front gate. There I showed the papers that I had reforged again while waiting in Turuf. They were blue stamp now, identifying me as Thener Benth, paroled convict, and attached to them was an order to report on or before Epps Thurn to Pulefin, Commensality 3rd Voluntary Farm, for 2 years guard duty. A sharp-eyed inspector would have been suspicious of those battered papers, but there were few sharp eyes here. Nothing easier than getting into prison. I was somewhat reassured as to the getting out. The chief guard on duty berated me for arriving a day later than my orders specified, and sent me to the barracks. Dinner was over, and luckily it was too late to issue me regulation boots and uniform and confiscate my own good clothing. They gave me no gun, but I found one handy while I scrounged around the kitchen, coaxing the cook for a bite to eat. The cook kept his gun hung on a nail behind the bake ovens. I stole it. It had no lethal setting. Perhaps none of the guards' guns did. They do not kill people on their farms. They let hunger and winter and despair do their murders for them. There were 30 or 40 jail keepers and 150 or 60 prisoners, none of them very well off, most of them sound asleep, though it was not much past fourth hour. I got a young guard to take me around and show me the prisoners asleep. I saw them in the staring light of the great room they slept in, and all but gave up my hope of acting that first night before I had drawn suspicion on myself. They were all hidden away on the long beds in their bags like babies in wombs, invisible, indistinguishable. All but one there, too long to hide, a dark face like a skull, eyes shut and sunken, a mat of long, fibrous hair. The luck that had turned in Ethwyn now turned the world with it under my hand. I never had a gift but one to know when the great wheel gives to a touch, to know an act. I had thought that foresight lost, last year in Erinrung, and never to be regained. A great delight it was to feel that certainty again, to know that I could steer my fortune and the world's chance like a bobsled down the steep, dangerous hour. Since I still went roaming and prying about, in my part as a restless, curious, dim-witted fellow, they wrote me onto the late watch shift. By midnight all but I and one other late watcher within doors slept. I kept up my shiftless poking about the place, wandering up and down from time to time by the long beds, I settled my plans and began to ready my will and body to enter Dotha, for my own strength would never suffice unaided by the strength out of the dark. A while before dawn I went into the sleeping room once more, and with the cook's gun gave Genli Ai a 1/100th second of stun to the brain, then hoisted him up, bag and all, and carried him out over my shoulder to the guardroom. "What's doing?" says the other guard, half asleep. "Let him be. He's dead." "Another one dead? By Mesha's guts, and not hardly winter yet." He turned his head sideways to look into the envoy's face as it hung down on my back. "That one, the pervert, is it? By the eye, I didn't believe all they say about carhiders till I took a look at him, the ugly freak he is. He spent all week on the long bed moaning and sighing, but I didn't think he'd die right off like that. Well, go dump him outside, where he'll keep till daylight. Don't stand there like a carry-loader with a sack of turds." I stopped by the inspection office on my way down the corridor, and I, being the guard, none stopped me from entering and looking till I found the wall panel that contained the alarms and switches. None was labeled, but guards had scratched letters beside the switches to jog their memory when haste was needed. Taking FF for fences, I turned that switch to cut the current to the outermost defenses of the farm, and then went on, pulling I along now by the shoulders. I came by the guard on duty in the watchroom by the door. I made a show of laboring to haul the dead load, for the Dotha strength was full within me, and I did not want it seen how easily, in fact, I could pull or carry the weight of a man heavier than myself. I said, "A dead prisoner. They said, get him out of the sleeping room. Where do I stow him?"
"I don't know. Get him outside. Under a roof so he won't get snow buried and float up stinking next spring in the thaws. It's snowing petitia."
He meant what we call silver snow, a thick, wet fall, the best of news to me.
"All right, all right," I said,
and lugged my load outside and around the corner of the barracks, out of his sight. I got eye up over my shoulders again, went northeast a few hundred yards, clambered up over the dead fence and slung my burden down, jumped down free, took up eye once more, and made off as fast as I could towards the river. I was not far from the fence when a whistle began to shriek and the floodlights went on. It snowed hard enough to hide me, but not hard enough to hide my tracks within minutes. Yet when I got down to the river, they were not yet on my trail. I went north on clear ground under the trees or through the water when there was no clear ground. The river, a hasty little tributary of the Esagel, was still unfrozen. Things were growing plain now in the dawn, and I went fast. In full Dotha, I found the envoy, though a long awkward load, no heavy one. Following the stream into the forest, I came to the ravine where my sledge was, and onto the sledge I strapped the envoy, loading my stuff around and over him till he was well hidden, and a weather sheet over all. Then I changed clothes and ate some food from my pack, for the great hunger one feels in long-sustained Dotha was already gnawing on me. Then I set off north on the main forest road. Before long, a pair of skiers came up with me. I was now dressed and equipped as a trapper, and told them that I was trying to catch up with Mavriva's outfit, which had gone north in the last days of Grende. They knew Mavriva, and accepted my story after a glance at my trapper's license. They were not expecting to find the escaped men heading north, for nothing lies north of Pulefin but the forest and the ice. They were perhaps not very interested in finding the escaped men at all. Why should they be? They went on, and only an hour later passed me again on their way back to the farm. One of them was the fellow I had stood late watch with. He had never seen my face, though he had had it before his eyes half the night. When they were surely gone, I turned off the road, and all that day followed a long half-circle back through the forest and the foothills east of the farm, coming in at last from the east, from the wilderness, to the hidden dell above Turuf where I had cached all my spare equipment. It was hard sledging in that much-folded land, with more than my weight to pull, but the snow was thick and already growing firm, and I was in Dotha. I had to maintain the condition, for once one lets the Dotha strength lapse, one is good for nothing at all. I had never maintained Dotha before for over an hour or so, but I knew that some of the old men can keep in the full strength for a day and a night or even longer, and my present need proved a good supplement to my training. In Dotha one does not worry much, and what anxiety I had was for the envoy, who should have waked long ago from the light dose of sonic I had given him. He never stirred, and I had no time to tend to him. Was his body so alien that what to us is mere paralysis was death to him? When the wheel turns under your hand, you must watch your words. And I had twice called him dead, and carried him as the dead are carried. The thought would come that this was then a dead man that I hauled across the hills, and that my luck and his life had gone to waste after all. All that I would sweat and swear, and the Dotha's strength would seem to run out of me like water out of a broken jar. But I went on, and the strength did not fail me till I had reached the cache in the foothills and set up the tent, and done what I could for Ai. I opened a box of hyperfood cubes, much of which I devoured, but some of which I got into him as a broth, for he looked near to starving. There were ulcers on his arms and breast, kept raw by the filthy sleeping bag he lay in. When these sores were cleaned, and he lay warm in the fur bag, as well hidden as winter and wilderness could hide him, there was no more I could do. Night had fallen, and the greater darkness, the payment for the voluntary summoning of the body's full strength, was coming hard upon me. To darkness I must entrust myself and him. We slept. Snow fell. All the night and day and night on my thang and sleep it must have snowed, no blizzard but the first great snowfall of winter. When at last I roused and pulled myself up to look out, the tent was half buried. Sunlight and blue shadows lay vivid on the snow. Far and high in the east one drift of grey dimmed the sky's brightness. The smoke of Udanushreka, nearest to us of the fire hills. Around the little peak of the tent lay the snow, mounds, hillocks, swells, slopes, all white, untrodden. Being still in the recovery period, I was very weak and sleepy. But whenever I could rouse myself, I gave Ai broth a little at a time, and in the evening of that day he came to life, if not to his wits. He sat up, crying out as if in great terror. When I knelt by him, he struggled to get away from me, and the effort being too much for him, fainted. That night he talked much, in no tongue I knew. It was strange, in that dark stillness of the wilds, to hear him mutter words of a language he had learned on another world than this. The next day was hard, for whenever I tried to look after him, he took me, I think, for one of the guards at the farm, and was in terror that I would give him some drug. He would break out into Orgota and Karhaidish, all babbled pitifully together, begging me not to, and he fought me with a panic strength. This happened again and again, and as I was still in Thangan, and weak of limb and will, it seemed I could not care for him at all. That day I thought that they had not only drugged but mind-changed him, leaving him insane or imbecile. Then I wished that he had died on the sledge in the Thor forest, or that I had never had any luck at all, but had been arrested as I left Mishnori and sent to some farm to work out my own damnation. I woke from sleep, and he was watching me. "Estreven?" he said in a weak, amazed whisper. Then my heart lifted up. I could reassure him and see to his needs, and that night we both slept well. The next day he was much improved and sat up to eat. The sores on his body were healing. I asked him what they were. "I don't know. I think the drugs caused them. They kept giving me injections." "To prevent Kemmer?" That was one report I had heard from men escaped or released from voluntary farms. "Yes. And others, I don't know what they were. Veridicals of some kind. They made me ill, and they kept giving them to me. What were they trying to find out? What could I tell them?" "They may have not so much been questioning as domesticating you."
"Domesticating?"
"Rendering you docile by a forced addiction to one of the Orgrevi derivatives. That practice is not unknown in Karhide. Or they may have been carrying out an experiment on you and the others. I have been told they test mind-changing drugs and techniques on prisoners in the farms. I doubted that when I heard it. Not now."
"You have these farms in Karhide?"
"In Karhide?" I said. "No." He rubbed his forehead fretfully.
"They say in Mishnori that there are no such places in Ogorain, I suppose."
"On the contrary, they'd boast of them, and show you tapes and pictures of the voluntary farms, where deviates are rehabilitated and vestigial tribal groups are given refuge. They might show you around the 1st District Voluntary Farm, just outside Mishnori, a fine show place from all accounts. If you believe that we have farms in Karhide, Mr. I, you overestimate us seriously. We are not a sophisticated people. He lay a long time staring at the glowing Chabe stove, which I had turned up till it gave out suffocating heat. Then he looked at me. You told me this morning, I know, but my mind wasn't clear, I think. Where are we? How did we get here? I told him again. You simply walked out with me? Mr. I, any one of you prisoners, or all of you together, could have walked out of that place any night. If you weren't starved, exhausted, demoralized, and drugged, and if you had winter clothing, and if you had somewhere to go. There's the catch. Where would you go, to a town? No papers. You're done for. Into the wilderness? No shelter. You're done for. In summer, I expect they bring more guards into Pulefin Farm. In winter, they use winter itself to guard it. He was scarcely listening. You couldn't carry me 100 feet, Estraven. Let alone run carrying me a couple of miles cross-country in the dark. I was in Dothar. He hesitated. Voluntarily induced? Yes. You are one of the Handarata? I was brought up in the Handara, and indwelt 2 years at Rothara Fastness. In Kermland, most people of the Inner Hearths are Handarata. I thought that after the Dotha period, the extreme drain on one's energy necessitated a sort of collapse. Yes, Pangan it's called, the Dark Sleep. It lasts much longer than the Dotha period, and once you enter the recovery period, it's very dangerous to try to resist it. I slept straight through 2 nights. I'm still in Thangon now. I couldn't walk over the hill, and hunger's part of it. I've eaten up most of the rations I'd planned to last me the week. All right, he said with peevish haste. I see. I believe you. What can I do but believe you? Here I am, here you are. But I don't understand. I don't understand what you did all this for. At that, my temper broke, and I must stare at the ice knife which lay close by my hand, not looking at him and not replying until I had controlled my anger. Fortunately, there was not yet much heat or quickness in my heart, and I said to myself that he was an ignorant man, a foreigner, ill-used, and frightened. So I arrived at justice and said, finally, I feel that it is in part my fault that you came to Ogorain and so to Pulefin Farm. I'm trying to amend my fault. You had nothing to do with my coming to Ogorain. Mr. I, we've seen the same events with different eyes. I wrongly thought they'd seem the same to us. Let me go back to last spring. I began to encourage King Argaven to wait, to make no decision concerning you or your mission about a half-month before the day of the ceremony of the Keystone. The audience was already planned, and it seemed best to go through with it, though without looking for any results from it. All this I thought you understood, and in that I erred. I took too much for granted. I didn't wish to offend you, to advise you. I thought you understood the danger of Pemer Harj Rem-Ir Tibe's sudden ascendancy in the Kyoremi. If Tibe had known any good reason to fear you, he would have accused you of serving a faction, and Argaven, who is very easily moved by fear, would likely have had you murdered. I wanted you down and safe, while Tibe was up and powerful. As it chanced, I went down with you. I was bound to fall, though I didn't know it would be that very night we talked together. But no one is Argaven's prime minister for long. After I received the order of exile, I could not communicate with you, lest I contaminate you with my disgrace, and so increase your peril. I came here to Ogorain. I tried to suggest to you that you should also come to Ogorain. I urged the men I distrusted least among the 33 commensals to grant you entry. You would not have got it without their favor. They saw, and I encouraged them to see in you a way towards power, a way out of the increasing rivalry with Karhide, and back towards the restoration of open trade, a chance perhaps to break the grip of the Sarf. But they are over-cautious men, afraid to act. Instead of proclaiming you, they hid you. and so lost their chance and sold you to the Sarf to save their own pelts. I counted too much on them, and therefore the fault is mine.
But for what purpose? All this intriguing, this hiding and power-seeking and plotting, what was it all for, Estervin? What were you after?
I was after what you're after. The alliance of my world with your worlds.
What did you think?
We were staring at each other across the glowing stove like a pair of wooden dolls.
You mean even if it was Ogorain that made the alliance, even if it was Ogorain,
Karhide would soon have followed.
Do you think I would play Shif Grethor when so much is at stake for all of us, all my fellow men? What does it matter which country wakens first, so long as we waken?
How the devil can I believe anything you say?
He burst out. Bodily weakness made his indignation sound aggrieved and whining.
If all this is true, you might have explained some of it earlier, last spring, and spared us both a trip to Polephon. Your efforts on my behalf
have failed,
and I've put you in pain and shame and danger. I know it.
But if I had tried to fight time for your sake, you would not be here now. You'd be in a grave in Erenrung. And there are now a few people in Karhide and a few in Ogorain who believe your story because they listened to me. They may yet serve you. My greatest error was, as you say, in making myself clear to you. I am not used to doing so. I am not used to giving or accepting either advice or blame.
I don't mean to be unjust, Estervin.
Yet you are. It is strange. I am the only man in all Gethin that has trusted you entirely. And I am the only man in Gethin that you have refused to trust. He put his head in his hands. He said at last, I'm sorry, Estervin. It was both apology and admission. The fact is, I said, that you're unable or unwilling to believe in the fact that I believe in you. I stood up, for my legs were cramped, and found I was trembling with anger and weariness. Teach me your mind speech, I said, trying to speak easily and with no rancor. Your language that has no lies in it. Teach me that. And then ask me why I did what I've done.
I should like to do that, Estervin. Chapter 15. To the Ice. I woke. Until now it had been strange, unbelievable, to wake up inside a dim cone of warmth, and to hear my reason tell me that it was a tent, that I lay in it alive, and that I was not still in Polephon Farm. This time there was no strangeness in my waking, but a grateful sense of peace. Sitting up, I yawned and tried to comb back my matted hair with my fingers. I looked at Estervin, stretched out sound asleep on his sleeping bag a couple of feet from me. He wore nothing but his breeches. He was hot. The dark, secret face was laid bare to the light, to my gaze. Estervin, asleep, looked a little stupid, like everyone asleep. A round, strong face, relaxed and remote, small drops of sweat on the upper lip and over the heavy eyebrows. I remembered how he had stood sweating on the parade stand in Erenrung, in panoply of rank and sunlight. I saw him now, defenseless and half-naked in a colder light, and for the first time saw him as he was. He woke late and was slow in waking. At last he staggered up, yawning, pulled on his shirt, stuck his head out to judge the weather, and then asked me if I wanted a cup of orsh. When he found that I had crawled about and brewed up a pot of the stuff with the water he had left in a pan as ice on the stove last night, he accepted a cup, thanked me stiffly, and sat down to drink it. Where do we go from here, Estervin?
It depends on where you want to go, Mr. I, and on what kind of travel you can manage.
What's the quickest way out of Ogorain?
West, to the coast. 30 miles or so.
What then?
The harbors will be freezing, or already frozen, here. In any case, no ships go out far in winter. It would be a matter of waiting and hiding somewhere until next spring, when the great traders go out to Sith and Perunter. None will be going to Karhide if the trade embargoes continue. We might work our passage on a trader. I'm out of money, unfortunately.
Is there any alternative?
Karhide. Overland.
How far is it? 1,000 miles?
Yes, by road. But we couldn't go on the roads. We wouldn't get past the first inspector. Our only way would be north, through the mountains, east across the Gobrin, and down to the border at Guthen Bay.
Across the Gobrin? The ice sheet, you mean?
He nodded.
It's not possible in winter, is it?
I think so, with luck, as in all winter journeys. In one respect, a glacier crossing is better in winter. The good weather, you know, tends to stay over the great glaciers where the ice reflects the heat of the sun. The storms are pushed out to the periphery. Therefore, the legends about the place inside the blizzard, that might be in our favor. Little else.
Then you seriously think there would have been no point taking you from Puleffin Farm if I did not?
He was still stiff, sore, grim. Last night's conversation had shaken us both.
And I take it that you consider the ice crossing a better risk than waiting about till spring for a sea crossing?
He nodded. Solitude,
he explained, laconic.
I thought it over for a while.
I hope you've taken my inadequacies into account. I'm not as cold-proof as you, nowhere near it. I'm no expert on skis. I'm not in good shape, though much improved, from a few days ago.
Again he nodded. I think we might make it, he said, with that complete simplicity I had so long taken for irony.
All right.
He glanced at me and drank down his cup of tea.
Tea it might as well be called, brewed from roasted permgrain. Orsh is a brown, sweet-sour drink. Strong in vitamins A and C, sugar, and a pleasant stimulant related to lobelin. Where there is no beer on winter, there is Orsh. Where there is neither beer nor Orsh, there are no people.
It will be hard, he said, setting down his cup. Very hard. Without luck, we will not make it.
I'd rather die up on the ice than in that cesspool you got me out of.
He cut off a chunk of dried bread apple, offered me a slice, and sat meditatively chewing. We'll need more food, he said.
What happens if we do make it to Karhide? To you, I mean. You're still proscribed.
He turned his dark, otter's glance on me. Yes. I suppose I'd stay on this side.
And when they found you'd helped their prisoner escape?
They needn't find it.
He smiled, bleak, and said,
First, we have to cross the ice.
I broke out. Listen, Esterton, will you forgive what I said yesterday?
No, sooth. He stood up, still chewing, put on his heb, coat, and boots, and slipped otter-like out the self-sealing valved door. From outside he stuck his head back in. I may be late or gone overnight. Can you manage here?
Yes.
All right. With that he was off. I never knew a person who reacted so wholly and rapidly to a changed situation as Estravan. I was recovering and willing to go. He was out of Thangan. The instant that was all clear, he was off. He was never rash or hurried, but he was always ready. It was the secret, no doubt, of the extraordinary political career he threw away for my sake. It was also the explanation of his belief in me and devotion to my mission. When I came, he was ready. Nobody else on Winter was. Yet he considered himself a slow man, poor in emergencies. Once he told me that, being so slow-thinking, he had to guide his acts by a general intuition of which way his luck was running, and that this intuition rarely failed him. He said it seriously. It may have been true. The foretellers of the fastnesses,
are not the only people in winter who can see ahead. They have tamed and trained the hunch, but not increased his certainty. In this matter, the Yomeshta also have a point. The gift is perhaps not strictly or simply one of foretelling, but is rather the power of seeing, if only for a flash, everything at once. Seeing whole. I kept the little heater stove at its hottest setting while Esterin was gone, and so got warm clear through for the first time in... how long? I thought it must be Thurn by now, the first month of winter and of a new year one, but I had lost count in Pulefin. The stove was one of those excellent and economical devices perfected by the Athenians in their millennial effort to outwit cold. Only the use of a fusion pack as power source could improve it. Its bionic-powered battery was good for 14 months' continuous use, its heat output was intense, it was stove, heater, and lantern all in one, and it weighed about 4 pounds. We'd never have got 50 miles without it. It must have cost a good deal of Estervan's money. That money I had loftily handed over to him in Mishnori. The tent, which was made of plastics developed for weather resistance and designed to cope with at least some of the inside water condensation that is the plague of tents in cold weather. The pestry fur sleeping bags, the clothes, skis, sledge, food supplies, everything was of the finest make and kind, lightweight, durable, expensive. If he had gone to get more food, what was he going to get it with? He did not return till nightfall next day. I had gone out several times on snowshoes, gathering strength and getting practice by waddling around the slopes of the snowy veil that hid our tent. I was competent on skis, but not much good on snowshoes. I dared not go far over the hilltops, lest I lose my backtrack. It was a wild country, steep, full of creeks and ravines, rising fast to the cloud-haunted mountains eastward. I had time to wonder what I would do in this forsaken place if Estraven did not come back. He came, swooping over the dusky hill. He was a magnificent skier, and stopped beside me, dirty and tired and heavy-laden. He had on his back a huge, sooty sack stuffed full of bundles. Father Christmas, who pops down the chimneys of old earth. The bundles contained kadic germ, dried bread apple, tea, and slabs of the hard, red, earthy-tasting sugar that Gathenians refine from one of their tubers. "How did you get all this?" "Stole it," said the one-time Prime Minister of Karhide, holding his hands over the stove, which had not yet turned down. He, even he, was cold. "In Turuf. Close thing." That was all I ever learned. He was not proud of his exploit, and not able to laugh at it. Stealing is a vile crime on winter. Indeed, the only man more despised than a thief is the suicide. "We'll use up this stuff first," he said, as I set a pan of snow on the stove to melt. "It's heavy." Most of the food he had laid in previously was hyperfood rations, a fortified, dehydrated, compressed, cubed mixture of high-energy foods. The Orgota name for it is Gitchi Michi, and that's what we called it, though, of course, we spoke Karhidish together. We had enough of it to last us 60 days at the minimal standard ration, a pound a day apiece. After he had washed up and eaten, Estervan sat a long time by the stove that night figuring out precisely what we had and how and when we must use it. We had no scales, and he had to estimate using a pound box of Gitchi Michi as standard. He knew, as do many Gathenians, the caloric and nutritive value of each food. He knew his own requirements under various conditions and how to estimate mine pretty closely. Such knowledge has high survival value on winter. When at last he had got our rations planned out, he rolled over onto his bag and went to sleep. During the night I heard him talking numbers out of his dreams, weights, days, distances. We had, very roughly, 800 miles to go. The first 100 would be north or northeast, going through the forest and across the northernmost spurs of the Sembensian range to the Great Glacier, the ice sheet that covers the double-lobed great continent, everywhere north of the 45th parallel, and in places dips down almost to the 35th. One of these southward extensions is in the region of the Fire Hills, the last peaks
of the Sembensians, and that region was our first goal. There among the mountains, Estevan reasoned, we should be able to get onto the surface of the ice sheet, either descending onto it from a mountain slope or climbing up to it on the slope of one of its effluent glaciers. Thereafter we would travel on the ice itself, eastward, for some 600 miles. Where its edge trends north again near the Bay of Guthen, we would come down off it and cut southeast a last 50 or 100 miles across the Shenshe Bogs, which by then should be 10 or 20 feet deep in snow, to the Karhaitish border. This route kept us clear from start to finish of inhabited or inhabitable country. We would not be meeting any inspectors. This was indubitably of the first importance. I had no papers, and Estevan said that his wouldn't hold up under any further forgeries. In any case, though I could pass for a Guthenian when no one expected anything else, I was not disguisable to an eye looking for me. In this respect, then, the way Estevan proposed for us was highly practical. In all other respects, it seemed perfectly insane. I kept my opinion to myself, for I fully meant what I'd said about preferring to die escaping, if it came down to a choice of deaths. Estevan, however, was still exploring alternatives. Next day, which we spent in loading and packing the sledge very carefully, he said, "If you raised the starship, when might it come?" "Anywhere between 8 days and a half month, depending on where it is in its solar orbit relative to Geffen. It might be on the other side of the sun."
"No sooner?"
"No sooner. The NAFAL motive can't be used within the solar system. The ship can come in only on rocket drive, which puts her at least 8 days away."
"Why?"
He tugged a cord tight and knotted it before he answered.
"I was considering the wisdom of trying to ask aid from your world, as mine seems unhelpful.
There's a radio beacon in Turuf."
"How powerful?"
"Not very. The nearest big transmitter would be in Kahume, about 400 miles south of here."
"Kahume is a big town, isn't it? 250,000 souls."
"We'd have to get the use of the radio transmitter somehow, then hide out for at least 8 days, with the SARF alerted. Not much chance."
He nodded.
I lugged the last sack of Kadic germ out of the tent, fitted it into its niche in the sledge load, and said, "If I had called the ship that night in Mishnore, the night you told me to, the night I was arrested, but Opsla had my Ansible, still has it, I suppose."
"Can he use it?"
"No, not even by chance."
Fiddling about.
"The coordinate settings are extremely complex, but if only I'd used it. If only I'd known the game was already over. That day," he said, and smiled. He was not one for regrets.
"You did, I think, but I didn't believe you."
When the sledge was loaded, he insisted that we spend the rest of the day doing nothing, storing energy. He lay in the tent, writing in a little notebook in his small, rapid, vertical cursive Karhaitish hand. He hadn't been able to keep up his journal during the past month, and that annoyed him. He was pretty methodical about that journal. Its writing was, I think, both an obligation to and a link with his family, the hearth of Estra. I learned that later, however. At the time, I didn't know what he was writing, and I sat waxing skis or doing nothing. I whistled a dance tune and stopped myself in the middle. We only had one tent, and if we were going to share it without driving each other mad, a certain amount of self-restraint of manners was evidently required. Estevan had looked up at my whistling, all right, but not with irritation. He looked at me rather dreamily and said,
"I wish I'd known about your ship last year."
"Why did they send you onto this world alone?" "The first envoy to a world always comes alone. One alien is a curiosity, two are an invasion."
"The first envoy's life is held cheap."
"No. The Ecumen really doesn't hold anybody's life cheap. So it follows, better to put one life in danger than 2 or 20. It's also very expensive and time-consuming, you know, shipping people over the big jumps. Anyhow, I asked for the job."
"In danger
Honor, he said. Evidently a proverb, for he added mildly, we'll be full of honor when we reach Carhide. When he spoke, I found myself believing that we would in fact reach Carhide. Across 800 miles of mountain, ravine, crevasse, volcano, glacier, ice sheet, frozen bog or frozen bay, all desolate, shelterless, and lifeless, in the storms of midwinter, in the middle of an ice age. He sat writing up his records with the same obdurate, patient thoroughness I had seen in a mad king up on a scaffolding mortaring a joint, and said, when we reach Carhide. His when was no mere dateless hope, either. He intended to reach Carhide by the 4th day of the 4th month of winter, Arhad Anar, to start tomorrow, the 13th of the 1st month, Tomenbod Thern. Our rations, as well as he could calculate, might be stretched at farthest to 3 Gathenian months, 78 days. So we would go 12 miles a day for 70 days, and get to Carhide on Arhad Anar. That was all settled. No more to do now but get a good sleep. We set off at dawn on snowshoes, in a thin, windless snowfall. The surface over the hills was Bessa, soft and still unpacked, what Terran skiers, I think, call wild snow. The sledge was heavy loaded. Estravan guessed the total weight to pull at something over 300 pounds. It was hard to pull in the fluffy snow, though it was as handy as a well-designed little boat. The runners were marvels, coated with a polymer that cut resistance almost to nothing, but of course that was no good when the whole thing was stuck in a drift. On such a surface, and going up and down slopes and gullies, we found it best to go one in harness pulling and one behind pushing. The snow fell fine and mild all day long. We stopped twice for a bite of food. In all the vast hilly country there was no sound. We went on, and all of a sudden it was twilight. We halted in a valley, very like the one we had left that morning, a dell among white-humped hills. I was so tired I staggered, yet I could not believe the day was over. We had covered, by the sledge meter, almost 15 miles. If we could go that well in soft snow, fully loaded, through a steep country whose hills and valleys all ran athwart our way, then surely we could do better up on the ice with hard snow, a level way, and a load always lighter. My trust in Esravan had been more willed than spontaneous. Now I believed him completely. We would be in Carhide in 70 days. "You've traveled like this before?" I asked him. "Sledged? Often. Long hauls? I went a couple of 100 miles on the Kerm ice one autumn, years ago." The lower end of Kermland, the mountainous southernmost peninsula of the Carhide semi-continent, is, like the north, glaciated. Humanity on the great continent of Gethin lives in a strip of land between two white walls. A further decrease of 8% in solar radiation, they calculate, would bring the walls creeping together. There would be no men, no land, only ice. "What for?"
"Curiosity? Adventure?"
He hesitated and smiled slightly. "The augmentation of the complexity and intensity of the field of intelligent life," he said, quoting one of my ecumenical quotations. "Ah, you were consciously extending the evolutionary tendency inherent in being, one manifestation of which is exploration." We were both well pleased with ourselves, sitting in the warm tent, drinking hot tea, and waiting for the Kadic germ porridge to boil.
"That's it," he said, 6 of us, all very young. My brother and I from Estra, 4 of our friends from Stok. There was no purpose for the journey. We wanted to see Terramander, a mountain that stands up out of the ice down there. Not many people have seen it from the land."
The porridge was ready, a different matter from the stiff bran mush of Puleffin Farm. It tasted like the roast chestnuts of Terra, and burned the mouth splendidly. "Warm through, benevolent," I said. "The best food I've eaten on Gethin has always been in your company, Estravan."
"Not at that banquet in Mishnori."
"No, that's true. You hate Orgarain, don't you?"
"Very few Orgota know how to cook."
"Hate Orgarain? No, how should I?
How does one hate a country or love one? Tybe talks about it.
I like the trick of it. I know people. I know towns, farms, hills and rivers and rocks. I know how the sun at sunset in autumn falls on the side of a certain ploughland in the hills. But what is the sense of giving a boundary to all that, of giving it a name and ceasing to love where the name ceases to apply? What is love of one's country? Is it hate of one's own country? Then it's not a good thing. Is it simply self-love? That's a good thing, but one mustn't make a virtue of it or a profession. Insofar as I love life, I love the hills of the domain of Estra, but that sort of love does not have a boundary line of hate. And beyond that I am ignorant, I hope.
Ignorant in the Hundara sense, to ignore the abstraction, to hold fast to the thing. There was in this attitude something feminine, a refusal of the abstract, the ideal, a submissiveness to the given, which rather displeased me. Yet he added, scrupulous, a man who doesn't detest a bad government is a fool. And if there were such a thing as a good government on earth, it would be a great joy to serve it.
There we understood each other.
I know something of that joy, I said.
Yes, so I judged.
I rinsed our bowls with hot water and dumped the rinsings out of the valve door of the tent. It was blind dark outside. Snow fell fine and thin, just visible in the oval dim shaft of light from the valve. Sealed again, in the dry warmth of the tent, we laid out our bags. He said something. "Give the bowls to me, Mr. I," or some such remark, and I said, "Is it going to be Mr. clear across the Gobrin ice?" He looked up and laughed. "I don't know what to call you. My name is Genli I. I know. You use my land name. I don't know what to call you either. Harth. Then I'm I. Who uses first names? Harth brothers or friends," he said. And saying it was remote, out of reach, 2 feet from me, in a tent 8 feet across. No answer to that. What is more arrogant than honesty? Cooled, I climbed into my fur bag. "Good night, I," said the alien. And the other alien said, "Good night, Harth. A friend. What is a friend in a world where any friend may be a lover at a new phase of the moon? Not I, locked in my virility. No friend to Therim Harth or any other of his race. Neither man nor woman, neither and both. Cyclic, lunar, metamorphosing under the hand's touch, changelings in the human cradle. They were no flesh of mine, no friends, no love between us. We slept. I woke once and heard the snow ticking thick and soft on the tent. Estraven was up at dawn getting breakfast. The day broke bright. We loaded up and were off as the sun gilded the tops of the scrubby bushes rimming the dell, Estraven pulling in harness and I as pusher and rudder at the stern. The snow was beginning to get a crust on it. On clear downslopes, we went like a dog team at a run. That day we skirted and then entered the forest that borders Pulefin Farm, the forest of dwarfs, thick-set, knurl-limbed, ice-bearded Thor trees. We dared not use the main road north, but logging roads lent their direction to us sometimes for a while, and as the forest was kept clear of fallen trees and undergrowth, we got on well. Once we were in Taranpath, there were fewer ravines or steep ridges. The sledge meter at evening said 20 miles for the day's run, and we were less tired than the night before. One palliative of winter on winter is that the days stay light. The planet has a few degrees of tilt to the plane of the ecliptic, not enough to make an appreciable seasonal difference in low latitudes. Season is not a hemispheric effect but a global one, a result of the elliptoid orbit. At the far and slow-moving end of the orbit, approaching and departing from Aphelion, There is just enough loss of solar radiation to disturb the already uneasy weather patterns, to chill down what is cold already and turn the wet gray summer into white, violent winter. Drier than the rest of the year, winter might be pleasanter, if it were not for the cold. The sun, when you see it, shines high. There is no slow bleeding away of light into the darkness, as on the polar slopes of Earth, where cold and night come on together. Gethin has a bright winter, bitter, terrible, and bright. We were 3 days getting through Taranpeth Forest. On the last, Estravan stopped and made camp early in order to set traps. He wanted to catch some pesri. They are one of the larger land animals of winter, about the size of a fox, oviparous vegetarians with a splendid coat of gray or white fur. He was after the meat, for pesri are edible. They were migrating south in vast numbers. They are so light-footed and solitary that we saw only two or three as we hauled, but the snow was thick-starred in every glade of the Thor forest, with countless little snowshoe tracks all heading south. Estravan's snares were full in an hour or two. He cleaned and cut up the 6 beasts, hung some of the meat to freeze, stewed some of our meal that night. Gathenians are not a hunting people because there is very little to hunt. No large herbivores, thus no large carnivores, except in the teeming seas. They fish and farm. I had never before seen a Gathenian with blood on his hands. Estravan looked at the white pelts. "There's a week's room and board for a pestry hunter," he said. "Gone to waste." He held out one for me to touch. The fur was so soft and deep that you could not be certain when your hand began to feel it. Our sleeping bags, coats, and hoods were lined with that same fur, an unsurpassed insulator, and very beautiful to see. "Hardly seems worth it," I said, "for a stew." Estravan gave me his brief, dark stare and said, "We need protein," and tossed away the pelts, where overnight the russi, the fierce little rat snakes, would devour them and the entrails and the bones and lick clean the bloody snow. He was right. He was generally right. There was a pound or two of edible meat on a pestry. I ate my half of the stew that night, and could have eaten his without noticing. Next morning, when we started up into the mountains, I was twice the sledge engine I had been. We went up that day. The beneficent snowfall and croxet, windless weather, 0 degrees Fahrenheit and 20 degrees, that had seen us through Taranpeth and out of range of probable pursuit, now dissolved wretchedly into above-freezing temperatures and rain. Now I began to understand why Gathenians complain when the temperature rises in winter and cheer up when it falls. In the city, rain is an inconvenience. To a traveler, it is a catastrophe. We hauled that sledge up the flanks of the Sambensians all morning through a deep, cold porridge of rain-sodden snow. By afternoon, on steep slopes, the snow was mostly gone. Torrents of rain, miles of mud and gravel. We cased the runners, put the wheels on the sledge, and hauled on up. As a wheeled cart, it was a bitch, sticking and tipping every moment. Dark fell before we found any shelter of cliff or cave to set up the tent in, so that, despite all our care, things got wet. Estravan had said that a tent such as ours would house us pretty comfortably in any weather at all, so long as we kept it dry inside. Once you can't dry out your bags, you lose too much body heat all night and you don't sleep well. Our food ration's too short to allow us to afford that. We can't count on any sunlight to dry things out, so we must not get them wet. I had listened, and had been as scrupulous as he about keeping snow and wet out of the tent, so that there was only the unavoidable moisture from our cooking and our lungs and pores to be evaporated. But this night everything was wet through before we could get the tent up. We huddled steaming over the chabe stove and presently had a stew of pestry meat to eat, hot and solid, good enough almost to compensate for everything else. The sledge meter, ignoring the hard uphill work we had done all day, said we had come only 9 miles. "First day we've done less than our stint," I said. Estravan nodded, and neatly cracked a leg bone for the marrow. He had chipped off his wet outer clothes and sat in shirt and breeches, barefoot, collar open. I was still too cold to take off my coat and kib and boots. There he sat, cracking marrow bones, neat, tough, durable, his sleek fur-like hair shedding the water like a bird's feathers. He dripped a little onto his shoulders like house eaves dripping. I never noticed it. He was not discouraged. He belonged here. The first meat ration had given me some intestinal cramps, and that night they got severe. I lay awake in the soggy darkness, loud with rain. At breakfast, he said, "You had a bad night."
"How did you know?"
"For he slept very deeply, scarcely moving, even when I left the tent." He gave me that look again. "What's wrong?"
"Diarrhea."
He winced and said savagely, "It's the meat."
"I suppose so."
"My fault. I should—"
"It's all right.
Can you travel?"
"Yes."
Rain fell and fell. A west wind off the sea kept the temperature in the 30s, even here at 3,000 or 4,000 feet of altitude. We never saw more than a quarter mile ahead through the gray mist and mass of rain. What slopes rose on above us I never looked up to see. Nothing to see but rain falling. We went by compass, keeping as much to northward as the cut and veer of the great slopes allowed. The glacier had been over these mountainsides in the hundreds of thousands of years it had been grinding back and forth across the north. There were tracks scored along granite slopes, long and straight as if cut with a great U-gouge. We could pull the sledge along those scratches sometimes as if along a road. I did best pulling. I could lean into the harness, and the work kept me warm. When we stopped for a bite of food at midday, I felt sick and cold and could not eat. We went on, climbing again now. Rain fell and fell and fell. Estravan stopped us under a great overhang of black rock along in mid-afternoon. He had the tent up almost before I was out of harness. He ordered me to go in and lie down. "I'm all right," I said. "You're not," he said. "Go on."
I obeyed, but I resented his tone. When he came into the tent with our night's needs, I sat up to cook, it being my turn. He told me in the same peremptory tone to lie still. "You needn't order me about," I said.
"I'm sorry," he said inflexibly, his back turned.
"I'm not sick, you know."
"No, I didn't know. If you won't say frankly, I must go by your looks. You haven't recovered your strength, and the going has been hard. I don't know where your limits lie."
"I'll tell you when I reach them."
I was galled by his patronizing. He was a head shorter than I, and built more like a woman than a man, more fat than muscle. When we hauled together, I had to shorten my pace to his, hold in my strength so as not to outpull him. A stallion in harness with a mule. "You're no longer ill, then?"
"No. Of course I'm tired, so are you."
"Yes, I am," he said. "I was anxious about you. We have a long way to go." He had not meant to patronize. He had thought me sick, and sick men take orders. He was frank, and expected a reciprocal frankness that I might not be able to supply. He, after all, had no standards of manliness, of virility, to complicate his pride. On the other hand, if he could lower all his standards of Schiffgräfer, as I realized he had done with me, perhaps I could dispense with the more competitive elements of my masculine self-respect, which he certainly understood as little as I understood Schiffgräfer. "How much of it did we cover today?" He looked around and smiled a little, gently.
6 miles, he said.
The next day we did 7 miles, the next day 12, and the day after that we came out of the rain and out of the clouds and out of the regions of mankind. It was the 9th day of our journey. We were 5,000 to 6,000 feet above sea level now, on a high plateau full of the evidences of recent mountain building and volcanism. We were in the fire hills of the Sambiencian Range. The plateau narrowed gradually to a valley, and the valley to a pass between long ridges. As we approached the end of the pass, the rain clouds were thinning and rending. A cold north wind dispersed them utterly, laying bare the peaks above the ridges to our right and left, basalt and snow, piebald and patchwork of